feel like the part that really screws people up is that half-white part. But that might be a very overly simplistic view of it. I just personally have seen, you know, let's get started, because I'm going to start saying things that are pertinent to the podcast.
I know, right? So with that, welcome to the third episode of Mixed Identity, the podcast where I, Heather Puri, your host, interview people of mixed identities. So we are starting mostly with mixed race or multi-ethnic identities, but I'm not limiting myself to that. I think that our identities are so multifaceted, but I personally find mixed race people's stories fascinating. So that's where I'm starting. And I started this podcast, as I said before, because I feel the need to collect these stories and share them with the wider world. And I know I've seen a lot more types of this conversations, but I want to talk to everyday folks, not famous writers or famous people who are multi-ethnic or mixed. Maybe I'll do that. I do have a goal of having Tawny Newsom from Yo, Is This Racist on, and Barack Obama. So I can do famous people one day, but I just want to start it out with everyday people. And so one of those very cool everyday people to go along with my theme is my youngest brother, Aaron Beal. Can you say hello?
Hi.
Hi. So he's here to talk to us. And so you already know who his parents are. His mom is Simpson and white, and his dad is a whole bunch of mixed up white stuff. You know our background, a little bit about our parents, because my sister Ruth and my brother Paul have talked about it. But with you and with Paul, I've been starting. How do you identify, Aaron?
Race-wise, I identify as Native Alaskan, but I feel a lot of white, too. It's definitely something where I think I am very much both of those things, and very much the best and worst of both of those things. So that's a very tip of the iceberg view, but yeah, that's how I identify.
So I want to dig into a little later what you mean by the best and worst of both those things. But first, I'd like you to tell us how you feel the world identifies you when you go out on the street, and how does the world perceive you, or how have you been perceived?
Definitely white. There's been one interaction ever where I feel like someone has like identified that I am not white, and that stands out in my memory.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was with a coworker that I had when I was just like 18, 19 at a call center, and he was he asked me where I was from. Because I went through, you know, the geographic locations I'd been through, but he was like, no, I feel like you look like you have some ethnicity to you. And then I told him that I'm a quarter Tsimshian, and, you know, to my biggest surprise, not only did he like validate that, but he like knew what Tsimshian culture was. Like, this white guy in Provo, Utah, working at a call center, knew like not just Tsimshian, but also knew Tlingit. I mean, this guy's now getting his second PhD in history, so he is a very informed person. But it was my first interaction, you know, outside of family, where someone perceived me as, you know, something besides white.
Yeah, I actually get it a lot, I think, but the one that sticks, the only time I've ever been identified as Native was when I was going to the University of Arizona, and I wanted to get my language credits out of the way, so I took Navajo, which, by the way, is the hardest language ever. And then I was struggling with pronunciation and things like that. And she was just like, come on, it's just like your language. Your dad's native, isn't he? And I was like, no, it's my mom. And I was just in utter shock because like she could tell I was native. And I was like, no, no one ever could. Professor Fox, man, it's an interesting and wonderful way of being identified as who you are when you're never identified as who you are. I felt yep. like it felt good. It felt like really good. Yeah. So can we go back to what you were talking about? What do you mean when you say the best of being an Alaska Native and the best of being white?
Well, the best parts of being an Alaska Native are, you know, sense of belonging to a community, sense of, you know, that community is transient and exists, you know, kind of wherever you do, at least on the west coast of the states. I feel like there's always a support network like that. And really the only other support network that I've belonged to that is like, they will help you any way they can, even if they've never met you. All you have to do is know someone else who like knows someone else who even knows the name of the community to go ask for help in the region. And the only thing that's ever even come close to that is, you know, Mormonism, where I can, you know, call up the ward and get someone to help me move or help me do whatever, wherever I am. And that's something mm-hmm. that is very, very present in Native culture. It is a fantastic sense of belonging that, you know, my door is open to anyone who needs help as long as they ask. And I think that is a very Native, or at least Native Alaskan, trait.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that I miss that a lot. And it is mostly on the West Coast. When I have lived in other communities, so whether in the Midwest or on the East Coast, I don't know if it's because there isn't a dominant Native culture there, especially on the East Coast, there isn't, at least where I was in New Jersey. But there was in where I lived in Wisconsin, there was close by, but I guess I never tapped into it. So maybe that might be what it is too. And it was easier to tap into on the West Coast than that. And that is one of the best things. So I would love, because, you know, you and I don't really, you know, white people, man. So what's good about being white?
Well, this is going to come off incredibly selfish and incredibly, you know, hopefully aware, but I have a lot of privilege by being perceived as a white person.
Yeah.
One of my favorite podcasters talks about the superpower that a tall white man in particular has, and that I can say anything with authority and people will just believe me. It's just privilege and everything. Like, it feels like I'm playing life on easy mode.
Can you tell us who that podcaster is? I will include a link to the podcast when I release it on the website.
Robert Evans, and his biggest podcast is Behind the Bastards, where he talks about terrible people in history, and lately has been doing a lot of stuff, in particular documenting fascism and the echoes of that in the modern day and what we can do to stop that.
Yeah, and it's really good. And he is white passing, but he is Arab, right? I think.
I didn't know if he was, like, I thought he was just white. He's from Texas and talks about being white. I've never heard him talk about being ethnic of any kind. He does have a great beard, though.
I've never seen a picture of him, but I do listen to that podcast too, since he recommended it. And he did talk about when he was over in Syria, he met the dictator, Bashar, over there when he had just taken over when he was a reporter. And he had asked how, I think he might be Syrian, but I don't know. Anyway, he is, and I do think he is probably, that might be why he is probably one of the few white men whose media I can currently consume. I just watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I just can't stomach Quentin Tarantino anymore. I don't know, something has switched in me where consumption of, like, media made for the masses, which means white dudes, just does not appeal to me very much. What do you feel like you, when it comes to consumption of media, and how your identity might affect that? Do you feel that it does?
I'm sure it does. I'm very thoughtless about it, though, because I tend to just consume things that interest me. And, you know, typically that is, nerdy things that are made. Arty Shapork, I really don't remember his name. He's the guy that does the Castlevania series on Netflix, and I just got into what is called his bootleg universe. And it's the first time where I've really been able to tell that there is a significantly different bent on the perspective than if it had been made by other people. And I think that's specifically because he is ripping off other franchises that were made for white guys. Mm-hmm. And doing his own riff on it. Like, he does a bootleg Judge Dredd, a bootleg Power Rangers, a bootleg James Bond, and it's very, very, very different from the source material. I don't know what his ethnicity is, but he's definitely a person of color, and that really shines through as a... I feel like there's a, you either have to be a very, very well-informed person, or you have to have lived it to be able to write another culture's perspective. Mm-hmm. And the best example of a white guy writing other cultures' perspective, that's going to be fantasy again, because I'm always reading fantasy. But is by Steven Erikson, and it's called the Malazan Book of the Fallen. And, you know, instead of being an author by background, this guy was a, you know, anthropologist, had multiple degrees, has done field research interviews, and didn't write his first novel till he was in his 50s. Mm-hmm. And it is such a clearly different perspective than, I go back to The Wheel of Time, which is a fantasy book that our family read a lot of. And it's so clearly by a white guy who does not understand what it is to, like, he gets a woman's perspective as though it's still like the way that he makes feminism, quote, feminism work in his fantasy world is they're the only people who are allowed to use magic. And I was talking about this with my girlfriend, and she's like, well, that's just like reversing the roles and making them more masculine and doesn't in any way address how, you know, there's power in femininity and power in being a woman. And really, like, it's things like that where I wonder how much that shaped my perspective, because I read some thousand thousands of pages of that in my formative teenage years that are like, what if I had read Malazan, or what if I had read other things that didn't form me in that same direction that, you know, society already was going in.
I think that, sorry to interrupt, but I love to hear about that. But I want to dig a little deeper into maybe your growing up and how you were influenced. You're talking about your media consumption, but you are, for context, much younger than the rest of us. And you grew up in this weird place of really kind of being an only child with older siblings who were kind of around. I mean, our oldest brother, by the time you were three, was right out of the house, I think, almost completely. Like, he was off to college and mission and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I remember when I was four, he went on his mission. I saw him not infrequently before he went on his mission, because Harvey Mudd wasn't too far away.
Yeah.
Definitely was gone and not around. Yeah.
So you have that, and you got more attention from our parents, whether that was good or bad. It was different. It wasn't, I don't think, of the way we were raised is good or bad, but it was different.
Saying that I got more attention from our parents might not actually be true. When I was younger, for sure, but by the time I was 15, they saw me for maybe dinner. And that was it.
Okay. So I guess I want to talk about the younger, because one of the things that, like, you actually, of all of us, have probably grown up, though mom did make an effort, and Simpson culture always played a part. She was working full time and had four other kids, and then you, a baby. And so it was a little harder, but you actually grew up with the stories, like the stories and how, which I am just starting to read as an adult. So the Simpson stories that were collected, I'm going to forget his name right now, but I'll link
Uncle
to it.
Uncle Gordon?
Uncle Russell went Uncle Russell, but the gentleman who collected them back, who he used to work with Franz Boas, he was half Jewish and half Simpson. I cannot remember his name off the top of my head. I'm going to do some Googling while you talk about how it was to grow up with the stories, and if it influenced them, and if it influenced you, and how it did.
I think I loved those stories. Those were great. Those were read to me right next to the Harry Potter books. So they were very much equally as large part of my life as, you know, regular fantasy and regular, you know, good night stories. I think something that is very, very present in all of those is to have a very healthy respect for nature, and that, you know, not just to have a respect for nature, but to recognize that I am part of nature. And I feel like that's something that I really keep hitting this a lot with people my age as I interact with them, is this idea that, you know, humans are different than animals, and that we are in some way better, and that we're not, you know, doing the exact same mistakes a million species before us have done. And that idea that we are in some way exceptional is something that I see it, and I just don't get it. It makes no sense to me. I'm part of nature, and nature's part of me, and they're inextricably tied together. And if I try and distance myself from that, or if I try and distance myself from, the way that I am part of this thing and it's part of me, like, it just seems to be something that is not always a fully formed idea for people, that they don't even think that, like, you know, it's natural versus unnatural. And like, it's something that, you know, we're humans and we make things and we're part of nature and we're distorting what nature is now. But that's something that I think is very core to all of those stories. In particular, one of my favorite ones is a story about these sheep that a bunch of villagers make fun of, and they also make fun of this other guy for spending time with the sheep and being friends with the sheep. And then, you know, the sheep decide, you know what, we're going to make them... Well, we're going to take care of you because you've been our friend. Go ahead and invite these people to a giant feast, and we, the sheep, are going to throw a feast for them. And they invite the villagers, and then the sheep cause a rock slide and bury all of the villagers who made fun of nature. And only save the person who was nice to them. All over the place that you need to respect nature, but you're also part of it.
So with this, so you have this deep kind of understanding of Simpson stories and Simpson culture, which I don't know, Ruth once termed that our association with it was more academic in nature, and kind of the way we didn't live it because we were the only Simpsons around where we lived, you know. But I feel like you have this grounding, but you also grew up differently than most of us. You grew up in a area that was predominantly white almost your whole life, with a very close Native American reservation, but they did not mix, even though you regularly drove across a reservation to get to where you needed to go. So you grew up in Mesa, Arizona, for the most part. And you have this, and you pass as white, and you're a kid. But was there any ever a time as a child where you were like, hey, I'm different? Or do you remember the first time you were like, I am not like those around me? Or Can you tell me a little bit about that?
It was while I was running cross country, and there were maybe four or five groups of kids that ran cross country. There were the really white guys. There were the natives. There were the Hispanics. And there were, like, you could slice that white guy group into some different ones if you wanted to, but I don't feel like it's important to the story. But I remember being in the locker room, and it was all pretty much all the white guys would go home after the morning practice to shower and get ready and then come back to class. None of the Native or Hispanic guys did that, oftentimes because they just didn't have a car and their parents could only drop them off once. And I didn't do it because I had, you know, an 8-hour class. It started, you know, before everyone else, so I didn't have time to go home and do that. But I would talk to these guys, and they basically asked me, like, why I didn't behave the same way as the rest of the white guys. And it kind of went on to a longer conversation of, I'm not really white like they are. Like, I know I look like that, but that's not me. And then, like, they were much nicer to me after that interaction. Like, they still teased me and gave me shit, but it was like positive way, the way that like an older brother would tease you, as opposed to the way like you would treat an oppressor, if that makes sense. But it was a very interesting interaction, and it made me realize that I am perceived differently than what I think I am. And that was the first time I came up against that.
Yeah, that is always interesting to have to explain who you are. And I'm going to be really interested to see how different this conversation is when we talk to Ken, when I talk to Ken, who's the only one of us who is not white passing siblings. But that's a cool story. I love stories like that where you just kind of are able to communicate that. I am in a place in my life where I am in a very predominantly white space. And the more I exist here, the less white I feel. And I think it's a class thing as well, because I also exist in a upper middle class, like, you know, area and lifestyle. I mean, we're not like the poorest in our area, you know, but the more I am here, the less I feel like I belong to whiteness. Though I have that pleasure. There's a world I don't get. Like there's part of it that I'm still trying to understand and figure out, especially as I'm trying to figure out my kids going through education in a white space, which I didn't grow up with, and the privileges that come with money, and any privileges they will not have because their skin is brown. But yeah, it is just so interesting because we are so put into where everybody pegs you, whether it's because the white guys pegged you as one of them, right? Like, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think most times white people are less aware. Like, when I'm thinking of people who have identified me as not white, I think only once in my life was it white people who were like, and they were like, "Are you part black?" And I was like, no, but I am part Native American. And I'm actually to the point where I don't even like to refer to myself as part. Like, I am a Simpson woman, which is what I like to identify as now. Like, and I will acknowledge that I'm white passing and how the world identifies me, but
I think one of the biggest reasons that we identify as part Native is because of the way that that's legislated for the United States government and paying money out, because it's the only ethnicity that you have to have a certain percentage of to say you're that ethnicity. It's the only one.
It's the only one, and it's genocide. It's the government's continued form of genocide of Native American peoples. I truly believe that. Like, it is in their way of trying to wipe out our culture and in the way of trying to kill the Indian and not the man. It is just a continued form of that because there are so few of us. I mean, even to the point where you could be a full-blooded Native American, but two tribes, and the government doesn't consider you 100% Native. They consider you 50% of whatever tribe you pick, and you have to pick that. And that's just so sad to me that I worked with this woman who I just ran into a few months ago. About 10 years ago, we worked together when I was doing my Sea Alaska internship, and she was Nez Perce and also Tlingit. And so the government did not recognize her. You can only enroll in one tribe. You cannot enroll in two. So even though there are plenty of people, and I'll ask you this, you have never had a Native girlfriend that I know of. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't told me, but has there ever been a period in your life where you were like, I don't want this to end with me, so I'm going to find myself a Simpson person to marry?
No. No.
I have. And then I was just, which this same woman I worked with who, and she, I was like, but I can't find any Simpson I'm not related to. And then we were talking, she's like, what about the Haywards from Heidelberg? She's like, they're really good looking. I was like, I know they are because I'm a Hayward. And so but for a while I was like, yes. And then I was like, I'm going to find myself. And then I was like, all right, it's not Simpson, but I'm going to find myself a native husband, which I think is really strange, right? Isn't that like,
why do you view that as strange?
Well, it's kind of like, well, I guess Mormons do it, right? They're just like, oh, like we weren't allowed to date anybody but Mormons.
I mean, I feel like everyone does this to a degree. Like, I don't know any culture that has never been xenophobic and self-progenerating. Like, I think that's hardwired into how human brains work is, I'm good, I want more of me, let's make more of me. So I think it's weird to never have thought that, and I kind of wonder why I didn't. I don't think it's abnormal.
Oh, okay. I thought I was abnormal. But then there, I also met this other Native woman who is Native from South Dakota. It was when we both earned a scholarship, and we ended up, and that's how we met. They took us out and awarded us a scholarship, and that's how we met. And she was in Minneapolis and I was in Madison, and so it's just a few hours away, so we saw each other a few times, but we like talked about it, and it was one of the things that was difficult was just we were both pretty well educated, and so finding native men who were also as well educated and someone you'd want to be around, if that makes sense. Like, because I do think education for me is actually one of the bigger drivers of relationship success. So I don't know what you think of that. But I ended up finding an Indian, just the wrong kind. the other kind, actually, the original
kind. The only kind.
Yeah, that's true. The only kind. The only kind. Have you heard the story of when we... when Ankit went up to Metlakatla with us?
No. Well, maybe, but I don't think so.
So this whole time I would joke that I was the right kind of Indian because I get a check from Sea Alaska. I get paid to be my kind of Indian.
Yeah.
And so I would tease him that I was the right kind and he'd be like, no. So we went up for the Ganhada potlatch, the Raven potlatch, about right after we were married. So about 7 years ago. And we, Mom and Ruth and I, were all up at the community hall making so much fry bread. It wasn't even funny, like so much fry bread he was just hanging out at Auntie Karen's house. And so this kid, 15, 16, 17 years old, like older teenager kid, comes in and he see, you know, it's Metlakatla, so everybody keeps their doors unlocked because if you steal anything, you're not getting anywhere. You know, so he comes in and he's looking at Ankit and he's like, oh, are you here for the potlatch? And he's like, yeah, I'm here for the potlatch. And he's like, oh, are you Raven? Are you Ganhada? And he's like, no, my wife is. And this boy just kept asking questions, trying to figure out, like, you know, I mean, Ankit is way browner than me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this young man was trying to figure out, like, who Ankit is. And he finally was like, where are you from? And he's like, oh, I'm from India. And he's like, oh, you're a real Indian. Oh my gosh, you're a real Indian. But so anyways, the whole time we were there, if Ankit was talking to like anyone and he saw, he'd run up and be like, this guy's a real Indian. This guy's a real Indian. So I have to say that Ankit's a real Indian from now on. And yeah. When you have gone back to Metlakatla or even come to the Pacific Northwest, do you feel any attachment to this land?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The Northwest is fantastic. Like, I enjoy the West Coast, but the Northwest is something absolutely special. I absolutely dream of the, there's a stretch of mostly dirt roads in British Columbia that I want to rent a motorcycle on and take 2, maybe 3 weeks off to travel, because it takes a tour of places that I you know, have read about, and places where it has totem poles all over, where I can see the rivers that they would put the salmon traps into. It is something I absolutely feel categorically drawn to. Even the like cold aspects of it, I probably would like those even more now that I spent a winter in Maine. You know, it's a definitely something that I am categorically drawn to, and feels as much like coming home as going home used to feel like.
Yeah. Well, if you are interested in that, one of the you should move up here, which I've been trying to get you to do. One of the members of our dance group is actually from Port Simpson, and she's from the BC side. So I am running against some kids who want my time. So we're going to wrap up maybe a little early. Maybe I can edit in some music or something. Cool. but I want to end with my final question, and that is talking about what right now are you into, that, and it can be media, it can be when Ruth was here, it was she was taking a great vacation. But what is just really sparking your interest or joy right now? Oh, and before I do that, the gentleman we were talking about who collected those stories was Henry Tate, and he worked closely with Franz Boas, who is a famous anthropologist. And so what was super cool is when Mom and I drove back from New Jersey to Arizona before starting business school, we actually went to Columbia and were able to like go to the special collections and put on white gloves and see his papers, his actual notebooks. He would write it in Tsimshian. He would write kind of the English translation of Tsimshian or Shmaliok, and then he would write the English translation. And then our Uncle Russell went to those papers and collected the stories, which is what we have now. And his name was Henry Tate. And if it isn't, I'll correct it on the website. So you are not so into the Tsimshian stories as much anymore, but what are you doing right now? And I will share mine, which I just finished a book called Vicious by V.E. Schwab. And it is the first book in a series called Villains. And I think I read it in 2.5 days. And I am partly tired, because I should have gone to sleep last night, but I needed to finish that book. I needed to know what happened. I know. And Friday and Saturday nights are the nights that I co-sleep with Rehan, which means I actually get some sleep. But it's just so good. And I think the one thing that I really like is it's about perspective. It's the author's a little sometimes on the nose about this. I don't think you need to write this in. Anyone intelligent will kind of get what he's trying to get at. But it is that villains and monsters are really perspective, and that there are that nobody, no villain wakes up in the morning saying, ha ha ha, I'm a villain. In real life, they have their motives. My favorite thing my favorite podcast, He Always Is Racist, Andrew T would often say that like Paul Ryan does not think he is a monster, even though Paul Ryan is a monster. He doesn't think so. He wakes up and he believes he's making the world a better place. Like I believe Mitch McConnell believes that. I believe that Trump believes that he is waking up every day to make the world a better place.
I don't know if I'd go that far with Mitch McConnell, because he seems to knowingly be using his office to just make money, But I don't think he would view that as a bad thing or as an amoral thing. So I agree with your sentiment.
Yeah, well, okay. Maybe he's not waking up to make the world a better place. Well, he's waking up to make his world a better place.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. But he doesn't think he's wrong. And for the most part, everything he does is actually legal.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
There's really good at that. He's really good at doing really shitty things that are very, very legal.
There's another set of rules that polite society went by that no one ever bothered to codify. And there's this new generation of grifters that have recognized that as long as it's not codified, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
And that's what they're taking advantage of. But that's very particular for me. I guess I should answer your question about what I'm really enjoying. My favorite TV show ever just finished. It's called Legion. It is a fantastic TV show that is all kinds of weird. The premise is that there is a person in an insane asylum, and he finds out that maybe he's not crazy, maybe he can just read people's minds. And it delves into a lot of what is mental illness, what causes mental illness, how do people become damaged, why is it important for us to recognize a damaged person, and what is appropriate to try and help a damaged person, and what makes a villain and what makes someone just be a person, and a lot of humanizing both there. It's really fantastic. It's really weird. The like psychic battles are often dance numbers, so all kinds of weird.
That sounds good. Maybe I'll give it a chance. I'm running low on things to watch, though. I find I don't have a lot of time. Well, thank you very much, Aaron, for joining me and chatting for about an hour. I really enjoyed it. And so I just want to remind our guests that if you like our listeners, that if you liked what you heard, you can find Mixed Identity at identitymixed.com or on all the socials at mixed_identity, except Instagram, which I just feel too old to be on, but I feel like I actually need to be on it because I think that's the only social network people are on now. I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not on it.
Good. You're young. You're a young millennial. I'm a very old millennial. No, wait. I'm the youngest Gen Xer. I'm not a millennial. My husband is, but I am not. I don't know, more identities to throw around that are labels that are put on you. So thank you so much for your time, and our theme music is Ice Flow by Kevin McLeod, licensed by Creative Commons. It can be found at filmmusic.io or incomtech.com.